From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Well, our connection this hour was made with America's first lobbyist. Do you know the story? I'm guessing you have a rather negative opinion of lobbyists and the practice known as lobbying. Every now and then, presidential candidates even promise to ban lobbying or pass some law preventing politicians from becoming lobbyists. It never seems to work. Lobbyists have a pretty poor reputation in this country, if you ask Pew Research. They found that Americans blame distrust in each other and in the government for the roadblock in solving major problems in this country. 75% of Americans say they are losing trust in the federal government, and 64% of Americans say they are losing trust in one another. Pew concludes, quote, "People link distrust to the major problems they see, such as concerns about ethics in government and the role of lobbyists," end quote. In other words, Americans don't trust that the government's working for them. Americans tend to think government is working to protect and promote the interests of the elite few. And by extension, Americans believe that lobbyists serve to make sure those elite few get what they want when they want it. Which brings us back to the story of the first lobbyist. Maybe it was a retired congressman going to work for the oil industry, writing energy policy. Maybe it was a defeated senator off to lobby for the NRA. Well, it turns out the story was quite different. Writing for the Gotham Gazette, Paul Hippolyte says, quote, "America's first known lobbyist was a Revolutionary War patriot, hired by fellow veterans to demand the federal government pay our soldiers the compensation they were owed. In the progressive era, the political class advocated to improve working conditions and labor practices. Lobbyists expanded educational opportunities and sought humane living conditions for the poor and fought for civil rights," end quote. Hippolyte's piece is titled, "I'm a Black Lobbyist, My Profession Must Change." He asserts, quote, "By dedicating themselves to work for the public good, lobbyists can save democracy and restore the American dream," end quote. Hippolyte has ties to Rochester, and now his goal is nothing less than reshaping the entire field of American lobbying, and he has very specific ideas on how to do it. Paul is the founder of Leading With Our Values, a government relations and public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice, and he's back with us now. One of my favorite conversations is always Paul Hippolyte. Nice to have you back here. Welcome.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for inviting me again.
Okay.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, no big deal. You just want to fix lobbying. I mean,
yes.
Seems pretty simple. any surprise that Pew Research finds that Americans don't trust lobbying?
No. And I think that also connects to the general distrust of our institutions across the board. I think Robert Putnam has a famous book, Bowling Alone. He's a Harvard professor and famous political theorist. And he talked about the decline over the last couple of decades of our institutions across the board. And people rightly believe that in terms of government, that lobbyists have a big role to play in our distrust and a distaste of government as a whole.
So before we talk about some of your work, you can probably guess what the general public would say about the practice of lobbying. But just for fun, I asked Twitter followers for a single word or a short phrase that immediately comes to mind when they think of lobbying. What are some of the words or phrases you think that I heard?
Probably bribery. Mm-hmm. Or maybe legalized bribery.
Oh, have you been reading my Twitter feed?
I have not, actually. I didn't even check that out.
I'm going to here are some of the examples. Five different followers used the word money. One said dirty money. Another used the chorus from the song, money, 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 money. Another five said greed. Several simply said corruption. A follower named Chris used the phrase, the fuel line for the engine of corruption. Here are several more. Bagman, swamp, crooked. Several used the word bribery. One used legalized bribery. A listener named Kat said a lobbyist is someone who is prioritizing the needs of a group, organization, corporation, or industry over those of regular citizens. Several used pay to play. One used the word scum. Ouch. But here's where it sort of gets interesting. More than a few followers use neutral or even positive terms to refer to lobbying. So several use the phrase access. One person wrote, a person who knows people in high places is a lobbyist. Two people use the word persuasion. And three, you're going to love this, Paul. Three people said the word lobbyist makes them think of the word advocate. And finally, a listener named Tom said a lobbyist is someone who is demonized and largely misunderstood. So I don't know if that was your burner account there. But, Paul.
That was not.
Any surprises?
And I wouldn't say that.
Any surprises with those responses?
No surprises. But what I would start off by saying is that lobbying is essential to any well-functioning democracy. And by that, I mean, if you have a government where folks aren't allowed to petition their government or to advocate on behalf of their issues, what you actually have is a despotic regime. You have back in the, before we had representative democracies, when we were mostly ruled by monarchs, whatever the king said for the most part, or the queen said, you had to abide by that. And if you complained, you better be careful how you did it and not to complain too loudly, or you may lose your head. And so our ability to, whether it's industry or nonprofits or everyday citizens, our ability and our ability to petition government to change the rules of the game or to govern in a way that serves the public interest, that is fundamental to our democracy, which is why it's protected in the First Amendment.
I'm going to have some fun with this conversation because I really believe in the mission of what you're doing and I admire it so much. And I'm going to try to play devil's advocate and poke holes in some of your arguments, even though I suspect I will not succeed, but I'm going to try. And it'll be a good little thought experiment. But before we do that, I want to also read a little bit from your piece, because you acknowledge that often how the public sees lobbyists is fair and accurate. It actually reminds me of what my dad told me when I was growing up. He was an attorney, and he said, Ev, you're going to hear people when you get older who refer to lawyers with pretty rough terms, and most of that will be deserved. That's what my dad said. He said, but he said that doesn't mean that the profession can't be improved or that people can't be doing things for the public good. It just means that there's too much of it that really is what the reputation and the stereotype is. And here's what you write about lobbyists in your piece. Quote, newly elected young progressives struggle to pass laws to make government work for ordinary Americans. Nonprofits and schools are squeezed at every turn. Where are the lobbyists? Mostly, they are making sure we don't tax billionaires while shoring up corporate profits. End quote. Generally speaking, is that how you see the industry? I want to talk to you about this because I'm not asking you to sort of bash your colleagues. I know you have a lot of love and affection for people you've worked with and people you will continue to work with. But generally speaking, is that how you see the industry at times?
Unfortunately, you have the industry is set up where people see it as clients hire a lobbyist to influence government. And the lobbyists, by and large, do not take position. Their job is to represent, almost like a lawyer would do, their job is to represent their clients to the best of their interests, regardless of what those interests may be. So there are, when I was starting this firm, as I was workshopping the idea with 74 people I workshopped the idea with, and as I was going through, I kept on hearing again and again, so you want to be a boutique firm, because there are lobbyists out there that will only work with certain nonprofits or certain groups. And that is, for folks that see themselves as doing good, that's the route that they take. And my position was to be a part of the small few that say, I'm going to hold myself to the standard, or I'm only going to work with these clients. I kept on thinking that's not enough. What I want to do is break the industry as it currently exists and use the powers that we have, use the instruments that we have right now to force change, versus just being a part of a select few that decide to operate differently. I want everyone to operate differently.
Well, I want to talk about how you get into lobbying to begin with, because I think a lot of Americans would probably say, if you ask them how does someone become a lobbyist, they would probably say lose a congressional race or go to Congress, leave Congress, get into lobbying. Tell me about your path.
Before I was an official lobbyist, I guess you could say, because it's how you see the term. And so I think I like to see it as a more expansive version of the term, which is an advocate. And I was doing that as an activist. I was doing that when I worked in the labor movement. I actually helped to train some of our members how to lobby their elected officials, because I had been in government before. And so what are the right arguments to make? What is in the elected officials' best interest, and how can you frame the argument in a way that you're going to get your desired result? And so even before I was doing it full time, there are all these different ways that I was helping folks advocate. Or, for example, when I sat with activists or friends that are organizers, and our goal is to push elected officials to implement better policies, part of what I would do is say, well, what argument are you making, and what is the best argument? And so I guess I see my trajectory is into lobbying this has been going on for a while before I did this full time. And when I started doing it full time, it was almost by accident. I wasn't looking to become a lobbyist. I met some folks that were in the industry through mutual friends. And when the position came up, when I was offered the job, I did some research and I saw a number of the things that they were advocating on behalf of. And I looked at, once I had my initial conversations, I looked at what the portfolio would be that I would be covering. So the tech world, nonprofit industry, civil rights organizations, healthcare, education. And I jumped at the opportunity because those are fields and interests and industries that I would like to help and see become better and become fully supported. And so I don't see it as it's all good or bad. I think there's a ton of good in the industry and there's a lot that they do. So for example, I've told this story already, which is I met some incredible friends in Rochester, and I ended up becoming a donor to my friends. They're amazing, a lesbian couple, and they're married, and they now have a kid who was born in January of this past year, of this year. And when I went to this lobbying firm, one of the first things we worked on was the surrogacy bill that was passed that has been stalled for a while. And we helped to pass that bill, which allowed my friends to become parents without having to go through the adoption process, because I was not on the birth certificate. I was not there as the father of their kid. And so whereas years ago or even last year, they would have had to pay thousands of dollars to adopt their own kid. And I would have had to go through this process and give up my rights and to the kid and all of these things. And we were able to get that done. And I'm really proud of that. And that was one of the first things I worked on. So this is just another example of all the good that happens in the lobbying world.
Without maybe being specific, I am curious if you then see also sort of the side of lobbying that turns the public stomach, or how often you encountered that, maybe not even in your own firm, but how you often sort of ran up against that in whether it was Washington or elsewhere.
I don't think that it happened in my case. It didn't happen often, but it was just, again, it's the way things are set up. So a good example would be you can have, I think I mentioned this in the piece, which is you can have the same lobbying firm that can help organizations, nonprofits that are trying to expand affordable housing, and the same firm can also work with groups that are trying to that have no interest in doing that, and instead are trying to roll back any good affordable housing policy. And so that stops me, because then I think, well, how can a firm be doing both of those things at the same time when those things are in opposition to each other? And the other thing is that, and especially in a place like New York City or New York State, where we have a lot of us have shared interests when it comes to our values. And so it's hard to imagine or to believe that we can't get some more of these policies passed that we all agree upon, or most of us agree on. And I think that the lobbying industry has an important role to play in either expanding and reaching those goals, or in hindering us from getting to those goals, if they do their job correctly.
Paul's got three ways that he wants to see lobbying change, and we're going to get to those three ways in just a moment. But what you just described is exactly why I think, outside of money, and we're going to talk about money in politics in a moment, it's why people might see this with so much cynicism. I mean, you and I think are pretty similar in that. I don't want to speak for you, Paul, but I tend not to think that the average person goes to bed at night thinking, "Boy, I'm a terrible person, but I fooled a bunch of people," or I voted this way because I'm evil, or I supported this cause because I know it's bad and I like being bad. I mean, I think most people feel like at the end of the day, they're doing good things, that they're on the right side, whatever side they're on. That doesn't justify it necessarily, but I don't think people think of themselves as sort of bad actors. I think for different reasons, people arrive at different places, sort of intellectually, honestly, in their own way. And that's why I think I'm not a big fan of sort of cancellation or cutting off relationships or cutting off communication, because closed doors will never get sort of bridges built. So, and I think you and I are pretty similar on that. But when someone works for a lobbying firm, let's pick, you talked about surrogacy, you talked about, your lesbian friends who probably at one point years ago were on the side of equal marriage. Let's say there was a lobbying firm that is paid to lobby on behalf of equal marriage, but also gets hired to lobby on behalf of denying equal marriage. That's when I think, how do you go to bed at night thinking, yeah, I'm doing good work here? I mean, if you're actually arguing both sides and getting paid for it, that to me is where you must know. I'm using the general you, not you, Paul, but you must know that something is wrong. Is that off base?
It's not off base. But also, I think it's just how people see the industry or how you see yourself in the industry. If your goal is to advance the cause of the public good, whatever that may be, or the interests of the public good, then I think that's where you would find that to be a problem. But if you see it as your job is to make the best argument or to advocate to the best of your ability for your clients, then taking that amoral approach is what will get you. Is what will take you down the wrong path.
Well, I agree with you that that's something that probably has to stop. Firms shouldn't be representing both sides of an issue. I'm with you on that. Looking at your three prongs here, I'm going to start with the one that I think stands out most to listeners, which is money. You write, we have to ban clients from giving money to politicians. And you write the following, quote, "Hiring a lobbyist is always an attempt to influence government. If the clients of lobbyists are giving money to those making the rules, you will not be able to convince the public that such transactions are not corruption. Perception is reality," end quote here. So let's work through a couple points there. How often in the real world of whether it's Washington or elsewhere, how often do clients also give money to government to try to influence?
I don't want to say all the time, but it happens all over the place. And there are many ways that they may do it. And so it could be through, for example, in New York State or even in the federal government. Sometimes this happens through what people know as PACs or super PACs, or in New York State, independent expenditures. So this could be that an elected official is running for office and someone who's trying to influence government will then put X amount of money into an independent expenditure or this other organization that then spends a lot of money to try to help elect the folks that they believe will help make rules or pass legislation that are in their favor. So that happens all over the place. And in this way, I actually have a pretty small C conservative view, which is I'm not even opposed to companies or businesses deciding that we want to give money to these elected officials. We believe these folks are good. I think that until we change the rules in terms of Citizens United, I'm a little bit more fluid or flexible on that front. But I believe that if company X gives $5 million to help elect a certain legislator, and that legislator turns around and passes legislation or rules in a certain industry to benefit company X, again, I don't see a world in which the public does not look at that and say that is cut and clear corruption. And I think this is a way for folks who want to do good to help companies do good and to also say that if you believe that you have good regulation, if you believe these are good regulations, if you believe these are good laws, then make the argument. And win or lose, elected officials need to be able to make decisions that are in the public's interest. And you already, by paying money for lobbyists, by having folks who can help craft your message and write the memo and get you in front of the right audiences, you already have a leg up. And so use those powers of persuasion to make the right argument and let your case stand or fall on its own. But when you are paying money or giving money to an elected and then they turn around and pass rules, again, it's going to be really hard to convince anyone that it isn't corruption.
So let me ask you a couple of points about perception versus reality. You can, I think, educate the public and listeners on this. One perception is that persuasion only works when it's attached to money. In other words, what really gets things done most of the time is money, not persuasion, even as good as an argument may be. Reality or not?
I think that legislators are much more easily influenced than we think. The problem
by
that
good,
I often
by good
see,
arguments?
By good arguments or even by a small minority of their constituents who are consistent, who make good arguments, who are able to organize others. And this happens all over the place. Elected officials are moved because they want to be reelected. And that's just, they are always fearful of losing the next election, and it happens all over the place. A good example would be Representative or former Congress member Joe Crowley, who was by many accounts second in line to be the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and he lost to a young upstart now Congress member AOC or Ms. Cortez, and this almost came out of nowhere, but it does happen. And so elected officials are often nervous about who's coming after them. They want to stay in their seat. They also want to do good, but they have the realities of getting reelected. And so if they have even a small number of their constituents who are persuasive, who are consistent with their message, who lobby to change rules or for them to vote a certain way, they often listen. They listen more often than not. And so it's up to us in terms of the general public to organize, to make the right argument, and to push and persuade our legislators to do our bidding. And so I think it's a lot easier than folks think it is. And money oftentimes can help color the argument or color the issue in a way that we don't like.
Okay,
just get rid of that.
Yeah, and so maybe two other perceptions then that you can help elucidate on reality or not is that when lawmakers are listening to lobbyists, at some point in the conversation, they will stick their palm out and say, "What's in it for me?" Essentially asking for some kind of financial contribution, support, et cetera, beyond just listening to the argument. Do lawmakers directly ask or make it clear that there has to be more than the argument, or is it the other way around? Lobbyists or companies go into it thinking that's what they have to do.
If that happens in D.C. or in other states, I'm not sure, but I've never been in a meeting where a legislator has ever asked for money.
Okay.
Or even mentioned anything about money.
Okay. So then the last perception that I think probably is reality is this. You are advocating for lobbyists to become advocates, not just sort of, you know, funneling money from clients to try to influence legislation, but trying to win the battle of ideas. And I love that and I admire that. But the perception is that if you and your firm give up putting money in the game, that other firms will not give that up and you're at a competitive disadvantage. And the only way to get where you want to go, which is banning clients from giving money to politicians, is a legal mechanism. In other words, the honor system or, you know, the change by public good and good habits ain't going to happen wide scale enough to change the industry. You got to ban it in, you know, in actual law. Yes or no?
No, because I'm not saying that that's not the route we should go eventually, but I'm saying that we don't have to wait for government to catch up to us. And again, especially in New York State, in New York State, we have so many folks that already want to go this path. They already want to clean up the industry, but also the lobbying industry runs on reputation. And so if you have a bad reputation, there is a way for us to, and I'm against cancel culture. I think I said this on your show already, but I'm against cancel culture as a whole, because I believe we're all in this community together. And we have to find ways to be generous to each other, to make the right arguments, and also to encourage each other to do better. But the part about cancel culture that I am in favor of is bringing what's in the dark to light, and encouraging and shaming each other in a way that will cause us to change our ways when they're not aligned with our community's values. And I think that can be done in this industry, where if we hold ourselves to a certain standard, if the lobbyists hold themselves to certain standards and other folks aren't doing that, then it's up to them to call out the other lobbyists. It's up to them to go to clients that are decent at these firms. And all the top firms, by the way, they all have a long list of really good clients and really good folks that are doing good work. And there's a way for a lobbyist to go after those clients and say, if you're with this firm, by the way, this firm is also representing these issues that are in direct conflict with your values and with our community's values. And you shame them to do better. And the elected officials also have a role to play. And when a lobbyist comes in with a client that's trying to influence government in a way that they know is harming the public's interest or the public good, they don't have to accept those meetings. They could shut down those. They can shut down those conversations. And by the way, I've seen this happen already. So it's not that this doesn't happen. It just needs to be a lot more widespread. And part of that means bringing these conversations to light that are currently happening behind closed doors, and then encouraging and empowering each other to push lobbyists to do better. But also that means that the corporations and the folks that are at those companies also have a role to play when they're hiring a lobbyist and when they're trying to influence government. They also need to think to themselves, well, what am I doing? What is the purpose of this? Does it have a broader public interest, or is this just to line our pockets up? And I know it almost sounds utopian, but I don't think it is. I think there are a number of companies that already operate this way, and it's just, how do we push and encourage each other to do better?
Well,
and I think we can do that.
I'll tell you why I don't think it's utopian, and this is where I think the whole notion on cancel culture is interesting and more complex, as you point out, Paul. Here's how I sort of take that, and let's see how much you and I align up on this. If the media, generally speaking, and if the public, generally speaking, had a better grip on what was happening with lobbying, then the media and the public would be better able to police the bad actors. I mean, right now, lobbying feels like a really distant, sort of shadowy thing that feels almost inherently corrupt or, you know, nefarious. And if it was more in the light, and if there was more education of journalists and education of the public about what we should expect, and then how to police when it doesn't go well, and I mean police with the tools that you're talking about, that's where either shaming or sunlight and public conversation comes in here. Not to cancel, not for the purpose of saying this person should be shunned forever and mocked forever and, you know, and dunking on Twitter, but instead for saying, hey, this should not be okay with us. This is causing problems. This is hurting people. We can hold these folks to better standards. And if not, then the consequences are going to be with our wallets and our votes. Then maybe there is some traction to be had there, and I don't think it's necessarily naive, but I'm always naive. So I don't. Does that make sense to you?
If I can, not only does it make sense, but it already happens. So, for example, after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist from Saudi Arabia, who we believe the Saudi Arabian government murdered him, there were a few firms, Washington lobbying firms, that were representing the Saudi Arabian government. And they were pressured to drop the government, and they did. This also happened with a lobbying firm, I believe, that does business in New York, too, that had ties to the Turkish government. And there were some activists that there was an issue going on, and there were activists that brought their issues to the public and started going after these lobbying firms, and they dropped it. And so this is not something that is, this actually happens. What I'm asking for is for more light to come into the industry. And for example, in New York State, if you go to the state J. Cope website, you can find out who the lobbyists are, which companies they're representing, or which interests they're representing, who pays them, and how much per month. This is all public knowledge. And it's not just for the journalists and for the public to go and to do the digging and figure out who's on what side of an issue. I'm saying that, to be even slightly more aggressive, that the lobbyists who believe that they're trying to do good, it's also up to them to police their own industry. It's up to them to shame each other. It's up to them to say, hey, you know you should be doing better. And I don't think that's far off. I think that this happens already in the corporate world. This happens where you have companies or you have customers, you have individuals that will go after companies that were, what, blood diamonds or the stuff going on, or apartheid in South Africa. I mean, again and again, we have a history in this country of going after companies that are involved in what we consider shady practices or behavior that we don't tolerate as a society. And I think we can use that power to encourage and to shame the lobbyists into doing better. And I don't think that it's far off. In a way, I think that this idea is probably just slightly ahead of the curve. And I hope this is the first of many firms that start to do this.
All right, one more note on cancel culture, and then we're going to dive into advising clients toward justice. But on the subject of cancel culture, I do not think that people should be forgiven for transgressions freely for no reason at all. I think forgiveness should be earned. I think we all sometimes need forgiveness, whether it's in our personal lives, professional lives. But my concern is that we are building more of a society, probably bolstered by social media and the velocity of some sort of memes, etc. I think we're building this society in which forgiveness is viewed as sort of weakness, and we don't want to forgive, and we don't want to even open the door. We want to shame and close the door and dunk on somebody and make sure that everybody knows that you're on the right team and they're on the wrong team. Do you think forgiveness is in too short supply, generally speaking?
I think the internet and especially Twitter world is a very bad way of representing who we are as a whole. I think it's a very small part of our lives, and I think probably journalists and the media pay a disproportionate attention to the Twitter world, which is not exactly the real
guilty.
World. So that's probably my first. That's probably my first comment on that. I find the conversations often to be very short-sighted and people often make, I think, very dishonest have very dishonest arguments and conversations on Twitter, which is why I mostly stay off of it. But I think there is a part of that where we often are speaking different languages, or we have a country right now where we're not always having the same conversation, and so it's easier to demonize each other. And I think a lot of times we often assume the worst of each other, or definitely people who may have a different political persuasion, and we often don't hear each other out. And so it's easy to say, well, you're dismissed or you're canceled. And to go even deeper, I think a lot of times that comes from an anxiety and a disappointment in our own shortcomings. And a lot of times when we go after others, what we really are doing is trying to dismiss or trying to suppress the parts of ourselves that we don't like.
I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Dr. Michael Mendoza joins us, Monroe County Commissioner of Public Health. We're looking at rising case numbers, concerns about what the next phase would be if we see more restrictions, what we can do to slow the spread of this virus, and how he thinks our community is doing We'll answer your questions as well with Dr. Mendoza Wednesday on Connections. We're going to run out of time if I'm not careful. My guest is Paul Hippolyte, the founder of Leading With Our Values, a government relations and public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. And Paul's joining us to talk about his work aimed at sort of redefining and reexamining the mission of lobbying. Lobbying has a very bad public reputation in this country, based on not just anecdote, but Pew Research, and that's not a surprise. But Paul says lobbying is essentially advocacy at its core, and there are questions about the rules, about the ethics, and about what the public can expect from lobbying going forward. And he really believes that with the right approach, lobbying doesn't have to be viewed this way. It can be working for good. So one of the prongs that you have for fixing and changing lobbying is this. You write, "We must advise clients towards justice." And you write the following, quote, "Before accepting a contract, a lobbyist must first ask, what is the goal and is this in the public's interest? Then counsel the client in creative ways to get there. For example, gig employers who can't afford to take on employees but want workers to have sick days, health care, and retirement might find a solution in pooled benefits," end quote. Now, on its surface, this is something, Paul, that nobody would disagree with, that we should all be working toward justice and, you know, high ideals. The difference, the problem, I guess, I see with this argument is that for everybody who thinks that one idea is the way to advance justice, there may be just as many others who believe that the opposite is the way to advance justice, and there's not sort of a baseline way to make sure lobbyists are, quote, on the side of justice on all causes. Now, I think there are some that are a little bit more cut and dry, and we can talk about that, but there's a lot of issues in which there's going to be a lot of disagreement, and how do you ensure that lobbyists and firms like this are actually working to advance justice as you see it, Paul?
I don't think it's simple or easy. I think that there are clear and cut issues sometimes that people know that they can, that they should be doing better. So for a good example would be in Rochester, for years, some of the largest companies were dumping toxic chemicals into the earth, into the water, into the river. We know that that's awful. There's no way around it, and we know that we could do better. And so if you're a lobbyist that you're trying to represent those companies that are doing that and trying to let them get around their responsibility to clean things up or to not dump toxic chemicals into the environment, you know you're doing the wrong thing. I'm not asking for people to sign a 24, 30, 50 point pledge of what they're going to do and not do. I'm saying that and the other reason why I'm not asking folks to do that is because the truth is that we're going to change over time and our society and our community standards will evolve. And I think that's a good thing. And so what may be seen as okay today may not be seen as okay 10 or 15 years from now. But I think there are fundamental things that we know are wrong, and folks will do it because they're getting paid to do it, not because they believe in what they're doing. And I'm just asking for people to hold themselves to a minimum standard of decency. And I don't think that's too much to ask. And in addition to that, I think this entire conversation, every time it's hard to have it because there's so much distrust and cynicism. And I guess I'm trying to appeal to the better angels of our society and say, this is something that we've always done as Americans. This is a proud part of our heritage, is seeing the world. The founders came from the old world where things had to be this way because of the culture and tradition and whatever. And they came to the new world and decided we don't have to live this way. We can reimagine our institutions and we can reimagine a world in a way that serves all of us for the public good and serves all of us better. And that's something that I think we can do in this arena as we can in many other arenas.
Is it as simple in this case as making sure that anyone who is a lobbyist is not taking on a client to make arguments with which they personally disagree?
I think that's a good start. It's hard because I have a broad set of standards of justice and these broad areas that I think cover a lot. But I, again, as I said, we will evolve over time, and what may be seen as acceptable today may not be seen as acceptable 30 or 40 years from now. And that's okay. We are all allowed to grow and to change and to be generous to each other and to forgive and to try to do better. But if that's our goal, I think we will get there together, and we'll be able to work together to create the better world.
Okay. When it comes to an issue, take gun laws. Let's say there is a debate about a new piece of legislation that would limit, what kind of firearms and how many people can own. And on one side, you have Americans who don't want to see the laws change. And what they will tell you is they don't want to see any violence and they don't want to see anyone hurt by guns. But they also believe that education is the key and that freedom is at the core of this country's founding. And you cannot take that freedom away of rights of firearm ownership without losing some of the fabric of what we are. And they hire lobbyists to make that argument. And on the other side, you've got people who say, look, we're going to let you own weapons, but we're not going to let you own the kind of weapons that can kill 100 people in a minute. And we're not going to let you own 1,000 firearms because you're not an army. There's going to be limits on this, and it's okay to put limits on that. It's a logical, sensible thing to do. Is there an argument on either side that you say should be obvious? I mean, is there an ethical standard that lobbyists should take into that kind of a battle over the legislation there? Is there a way that you think things should change?
Think in that argument, for example, the vast majority of the public is on one side, especially in a state like New York.
Okay, but
And
not in the
so,
Dakotas, for example.
correct. And maybe the laws or the conversation in the Dakotas may be different. But what I will say is that if you're one firm that is making both arguments, my guess is that one of those is dishonest. And another thing that, I mean, part of it too is just trying to sit down with your client and figure out like what is the value behind what we are trying to do? What in this is in the public's interest, and how do we get there? And sometimes it's going to be hard, it's going to be difficult, but that should be a part of the conversation that lobbyists have with their clients. It shouldn't just be someone hires you to do a job and you just do it. It should also actually have a, you should actually sit down with your client and say, well, what is in the public's interest? What are we doing here? What is our purpose? And take that seriously. I think if you're trying to influence government, as I said in the piece, you're trying to influence the public. And so that's a heavy responsibility that we should take a lot more seriously than we currently are.
Your last prong on fixing lobbying says, be an organizer. And you write the following, quote, lobbyists have a responsibility to organize constituencies, corporations, nonprofits, and citizens to solve big problems. Lobbyists need to leverage their collective knowledge and expertise, their trusted relationships with elected officials, and their clout in the business community to help shape our democracy into one that secures life, liberty, justice, and prosperity for all, end quote. How do you do that?
That's a good question. I think part of what I see are so many issues that we have. And as I said in the piece, the lobbyists are former elected officials. They're former labor leaders. They have an incredible amount of connections, and the business community needs them to help navigate government. But often there are all these bigger issues that the public is asking for change and asking, crying out for someone. I mean, the recent protests this past year around the public safety and the racial unrest, this is something that lobbyists can jump in and say, okay, I see all these companies that are coming out with their Black Lives Matter statements and trying to do some good or whatever it may be. And the lobbyists can sit with companies and say, okay, do you want to do good? Let's do good. Let's sit with the activists and the companies and the elected officials, and let's come up with a plan and figure out like what are good changes that we can make together. These are networks that already exist and people that already know how to do this work. It's just they don't necessarily see it as part of their job to try to help change the system or advance the public's interest. And if that is their goal, well, then they'll see problems all over the place that they can help solve. This past year has shown the problems that we have in the middle of the pandemic, where we have huge sections of New York State, huge areas in New York State that don't have access to internet, or just students that need to do work that don't have devices, that don't have access to the internet, that can't continue their education in a digital age. That shouldn't be. And so again, just there, I can go down the list. My brain is overflowing right now, because there's so many issues all over the place. And the lobbying industry doesn't need to wait for a client to come to them to say, can you help advocate on behalf of this? Part of their job should be, as they're seeing some of these problems that are happening, how can they put together the right pieces to make sure that government is doing what it should be doing?
Let me squeeze in two more quick questions and we're done with you, Paul. And I really appreciate the time. And again, I want to say I really appreciate the mission of what you're trying to do with lobbying. You use in the title of your piece, you use the phrase black lobbyists. Black lobbyists. You write, I'm a black lobbyist. How important is it to understand racial inequity, especially when it comes to power in Washington? And how does race come into play when you think about lobbying?
So when I say black lobbyists, I was thinking more than just my race. I define black actually on my website as a political consciousness, seeing the world through the eyes of the marginalized and engaged in the struggle for justice. And by that, I mean it's a way of seeing the world and not just the color of my skin. And I think if more of us can challenge ourselves to see the world through the eyes of the marginalized, it looks different. If your goal, regardless of what you're doing, regardless of your path in life, is just to make money or to protect the privileged or whatever it may be, then I think you're going to find that you're not doing work on behalf of the public good. And I'm not saying that everyone is going to see the world that way. But I think if you're going to be doing work on behalf of the public good, it behooves us to see the world through the eyes of the marginalized and always try to think of how do you make the argument, or what kind of work are you doing that advances the public's interest at large?
And finally, Paul, if you're going to get the change that you want in lobbying as an industry, if you and your firm is going to lead in this way, and you're going to attract other talent and colleagues to join you in this cause, to advise clients toward justice, to stop clients from giving money to politicians anymore, to become organizers and really invested in values, not just working to cash a check, you've got to convince people to get on board. And now that people have seen your piece and you've talked to some colleagues, can you characterize what you're hearing from your colleagues? Are they telling you, this is amazing stuff, good luck, I want to join you? Are they telling you, this is naive and ridiculous and nothing will change? What are you hearing?
I have had a lot of meetings since the piece came out, including some lobbyists from some of the top firms in the state who have asked me, what can they do to help? How can they join? And a number of folks that said, look, I've been thinking about this, I've been feeling this, and I didn't know what to do or what can be done to change things. And I'm not just saying that. I've had meeting after meeting now with so many folks who've said, like, let me know what I can do to help. And it's been so encouraging. The truth is that as I was doing this, I felt like I was jumping off of a cliff. And part of me workshopping the idea with 74 of my friends and mentors and people I trust was because I was going through a lot, and I really was struggling and trying to think, well, am I really on the right path? Or am I actually losing it? Am I seeing this correctly? And the truth is that I wasn't always sure. And this is probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. But after what I've been through and knowing that I got into this to do what I thought was in the public's interest and to do what I thought was right, felt like I didn't have a choice. And the truth is that not only were my friends and mentors and folks that at first were, probably everyone was hesitant at first when I started the conversation, but by the end of it, when they could hear the burning desire I had to do this, I had a number of folks that told me, like, if this is going to happen, if someone's going to do it, you're going to be able to do it. But since it started, the truth is that as a small startup, I've had a number of people, half dozen people that have helped me, that have poured in hours and hours volunteering on a startup for-profit company, not even necessarily expecting to be a part of it or to get paid, just because they're like, this has to work. We want to see this work. And I think that's what keeps driving me. There's such a long list of people that I would have to thank, but the truth is that without them, I would have stopped a long time ago. And also my family. Every time I share this or share an article or share a conversation that I'm having about this, they give me so much support, knowing that they are not interested in the political world, but they believe that my heart's in the right place and they trust me. And I know I have to do this for them, and for all the people that want to see a better world.
Paul, always great talking to you. And I want to tell you, there's a small group of people who come on the program, and our listeners, every time they're on, they say, you should have them on once a week. And you're on that list. I hear that all the time. So that's why I bug you so much. I'm so sorry.
Thank you so much. This is a tough conversation, but thank you. It's necessary and needed. Thank you so much.
It is important. And Paul's piece, I'm a Black Lobbyist, My Profession Must Change, we'll post it to our various platforms. He's the founder of Leading With Our Values, a government relations and public affairs firm committed to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Evan Dawson. For Megan Mack, Rob Braden, have a great afternoon.